I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KVOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. In that spirit, Bill Resnick begins our program this morning with an interview with Hillary Wainwright. Wainwright is a writer, socialist feminist, and activist organizer in London. She was a major player in the Greater London Council that the Thatcher government abolished when the council's many egalitarian and democratic programs grew too threatening. Out of that experience, Wainwright wrote several books, such as A Taste of Power, The Politics of Local Economics. She has carried those politics into the wonderful journal Red Pepper out of London that she co-edits. They'll discuss the recent mutiny of the 99%. We all know people who say they're fiscally conservative but socially liberal. Is this position coherent? Following Bill, I'll share portions of an abbreviated article by Greta Christiana, who forcefully argues that it is not. Later in the program, Fran Michel will continue a discussion she has reported on previously regarding which of our two main presidential candidates is the lesser evil. Larry Bolden reviews a novel by a Nigerian woman author who came to the U.S. as an academic and then returned, having acquired American ways, American taste, and an American-eyed view of the world. The book is entitled Americana, and it's by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I'll conclude today's program with an article by Sam Fisher entitled Post-Paris Climate Talks, Implementation at Any Cost. What does it mean to be fiscally conservative but socially liberal? As far as I can tell, socially liberal is merely a declaration that, unlike a common stereotype of conservatives, especially Christian fundamentalist and Tea Party conservatives, they are not prejudiced against people of another race, religion, or gender identity, which tacitly acknowledges that they know they keep some pretty unsavory company. It is a conservatism that helps no one and costs them nothing. What follows in an article by Greta Christina entitled, People Who Say They're Fiscally Conservative But Socially Liberal Don't Understand. Social and economic issues are deeply intertwined. The article begins, Well, I'm conservative, but I'm not one of those racist, homophobic, dripping with hate Tea Party bigots. I'm pro-choice. I'm pro-same-sex marriage. I'm not a racist. I just want lower taxes and smaller government and less government regulation of business. I'm fiscally conservative and socially liberal. How many liberals and progressives have heard this? It's ridiculously common. Even Dick Koch of the Koch brothers has said, I'm a conservative on economic matters and I'm a social liberal. And it's wrong. W-R-O-N-G, wrong. You can't separate fiscal issues from social issues. They're deeply intertwined. They affect each other. Economic issues often are social issues, and conservative fiscal policies do enormous social harm. That's true even for the mildest, most generous version of fiscal conservatism, low taxes, small government, reduced regulation, a free market. These policies perpetuate human rights abuses. They make life harder for people who already have hard lives. Even if the people supporting these policies don't intend this, the policies are racist, sexist, classist, obviously homophobic, transphobic, and otherwise socially retrograde. In many ways, they do more harm than the so-called social policies that are supposedly separate from economic ones. Now, there are conservatives who insist that this isn't what fiscally conservative means. They're not inherently opposed to government spending, they say. They're just opposed to ineffective and wasteful government spending. Do they really think the progressives are in favor of wasteful and ineffective government? Do they think we're saying, thumbs up to ineffective government spending? Let's pour our government resources down a rat hole. Let's spend our tax money giving every citizen a solid gold tuba and a lifetime subscription to Cigar Aficionado. That is an idealized, self-serving definition of fiscally conservative, defined by conservatives to make their position seem reasonable. It does not describe fiscal conservatism as it actually plays out in the United States. The reality of fiscal conservatism in the United States is not cautious, evidence-based attention to which government programs do and don't work. If that were true in some misty nostalgic past, it hasn't been true for a long, long time. The reality of fiscal conservatism in the United States means slashing government programs, even when they've been shown to work. The reality means decimating government regulations, even when they've been shown to improve people's lives. The reality means cutting the safety net to ribbons and letting big business do pretty much whatever they want. You can say all you want that modern conservatism in the United States isn't what you personally mean by conservatism, but hanging on to some ideal of conservatism as a model of sensible but compassionate frugality that's being betrayed by the Koch brothers and Tea Party. It's like hanging on to some ideal of republicanism as the party of abolition Lincoln, and it lends credibility to the idea that conservatism is reasonable if only people would do it right. If you care about marginalized people, if you care about the oppression of women, LGBT people, disabled people, African Americans, Hispanics, and other people of color, you need to do more than go to same-sex weddings and listen to hip-hop. You need to support economic policies that make marginalized people's lives better. You need to oppose economic policies that perpetuate human rights abuses and make marginalized people's lives suck. And that means not being a fiscal conservative. That was an article entitled, "People Say They're Fiscally Conservative but Socially Liberal but Don't Understand. Social and Economic Issues Are Deeply Intertwined." It's by Greta Christina for Alternet. Christina is the author of Coming Out Atheist, How to Do It and How to Help Each Other and Why, available in ebook, print, and audiobook. Now let's see if we have Bill's interview with Hillary Wainwright.
Hi, Hillary Wainwright. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Good to be here. Well, I'm in London, but it's good to be talking to you.
Hillary Wainwright is a writer, activist, organizer in London, England. She was a major player in the Greater London Council that governed London for 4 years back in the 1980s, the early 1980s. The council initiated a host of efforts creating jobs, democratizing public services, giving workers more of a say in what they do, and encouraging real popular participation in societal decision-making, and also building opportunities for that participation. The council, of course, was under left leadership. It was so threatened to the conservatives that were running England at that time that they pushed through Parliament a law abolishing the council and replacing it with more easily controllable local organizations. But, of course, the council lives on, like the Paris Commune, in the memories and in the testimonies of the participants. And Hillary Wainwright's experiences in the council led to several of her books, including A Taste of Power, The Politics of Local Economics, Public Service Reform, But Not as We Know It, and Reclaim the State, Experiments in Popular Democracy. And now she carries those politics into the wonderful journal Red Pepper out of London that she co-edits. Hillary Wainwright, for me, the last several months in both the U.S. and England, they were exhilarating. In both countries, it seemed to me, it was a mutiny at the 99%, and it seemed to me to represent the emergence of a new politics that has, in fact, been incubating on the ground for some time. On the other side, nasty right-wing forces have also recognized popular distress and are also organizing to impose their vision of the new coming society. So, Hillary Wainwright, give us your sense of what it all means and the opportunities for the left, but also the grim possibilities. And then we can get to the kind of organizing that you've written about that now seems called for. So first, what's happening around the international and national and local possibilities been grim and wonderful?
Okay, Bill, well, that's a big ask, but I'll begin with what I'm familiar with, which is in Britain, to some extent, other parts of Europe, and then consider or ask you to consider how far this is generalizable. But I suppose first one's got to recognize that these developments, whether it's the movement that has been ignited by Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party, which one's got to remember, he was a reluctant leader, and before he stood, there was not really an organized left of any strength inside the Labour Party. I mean, his candidature, the fact he got onto the list, sort of somehow became like a sort of spark that lit a fire, that was in very arid terrain, you know, where people were desperate, were thirsty for some kind of alternative and some kind of authentic representation. I mean, I think the context here and in Spain and in Greece, is a context where politics had become totally blocked. I mean, a mixture of the kind of hollowing out of democracy by globalization, the growth of global corporations that increasingly effectively took over or certainly gained incredible power at a national level, meaning that national governments had very little power and became increasingly acquiescent in the demands of the corporations, which led to governments that were very, very little difference from each other. So the Conservative Party here, even Mrs. Thatcher's Conservative Party, you know, was not really very different from Tony Blair's Labour Party, who, you know, which kind of imitated aspects of Thatcherism. At the same time, one saw the same situation in Greece and in Spain and to some degree in Italy, you know, where political elites seemed less and less responsive to their people. At the same time, you saw a process of consolidating of the political elites, so a political caste, as Podemos in Spain talks about it. It refers to La Casta, a political caste of professional politicians who really often had not gained their position through mobilizing and winning people in the party, but who'd gained their position by being appointed by party elites. So it was a sort of self-reproducing process, and parliaments had become less and less responsive to the needs and demands of ordinary people. So politics was increasingly spun. It was increasingly a media, product of media images. So people were facing more and more intense social problems, but with less and less possibilities of political expression about these problems and political solutions above all. So in that sense, it never took much organization building to spark some kind of revolt. In a way, both Podemos, I suppose, was more product of the mass movements around the indignados, the squares, which in some ways are replicated by the Occupy movement in the US, though they came before the Occupy movement. In Britain, we did have a small Occupy. We've had many, many local protests. But it wasn't until Corbyn's candidature that we gained a sort of political voice, if you like. But that wasn't preceded by a strong, you know, build-up of organization. In a funny way, the voice then stimulated the self-organization.
You know, in the United States, what you describe, I mean, there are differences, of course, but that same hollowing out of politics and the same desperation at many levels of the working class, it's the same. And in fact, Sanders and Corbyn, they are in many ways an expression of the same deep problems and the possibilities. Why don't you go on, in fact, and talk about those possibilities that seem to be emerging?
Yes, I think they're still quite hesitant because I think people have not yet developed a different model of change. So there's still a hope in Britain, maybe in the States, I don't know, that a leader like Jeremy or like Sanders will introduce change through the existing political system. So there's a recognition that there has to be a movement supporting these figures, but it's not yet clear the extent to which it has to be a creative movement, creating new forms of production, new forms of social organization, and even new forms of economic production, retailing, money, the whole political system. And so I think at the moment we're in a bit of a transition where people are beginning to realize that they're up against a political system that is not going to give in easily. When it sees an enemy like Corbyn, it doesn't cave in. It rallies and tries to build a wider alliance that it can use to destroy people like Clinton like Corbyn and Sanders. You know, I think the same applies to Sanders. If he'd got anywhere much further towards the nomination, the sort of elders of the Democratic Party would have knocked him back. And I think that's what we're now seeing in the Labour Party. So we're maybe into the next phase, which is more challenging. I mean, Podemos didn't do very well in the elections, but they still seem to be standing firm. And across the country, Podemos members or members of the United Left are saying, you know, how do we learn from the experiences of the past? What do we need to do better to reach the working class people who we've lost? So I think we haven't yet found a solution. I think personally a lot depends on new forms of production, new forms of economy emerging from movement.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Hillary Wainwright, who edits the journal Red Pepper. She's written a lot of books, many on her experience in the Greater London Council. She's now editor of Red Pepper. She's writing about and soliciting articles on the New Age and politics, and particularly about the surge in resistant politics and grassroots and neighborhood self-organizing. Hillary Wainwright, you talked about this is the beginning of a new age of politics, this sort of emerging working class movements at the grassroots that have to pioneer a very different way of managing the society and economy and production and daily life and living together. You pointed out that it's still this organizing at the grassroots is still embryonic and hasn't reached probably most people. I think that'll probably be true for quite a while. My hypothesis is that things start getting really worse, particularly kind of spiking of food prices, more evictions and homelessness, more parts of the city that have been abandoned and completely disinvested in. That is if an environmental crisis occurs, and that may be in many years. It seems to me these movements, though, are really, really important. Movements for localizing energy, movements for more public transit, movements for public jobs and rebuilding infrastructure, and doing it, in fact. And some cities are succeeding. There are examples. It seems to me at the time when the crisis really hits home to most working people and there are no ways of avoiding it, either psychologically or by just trying to work harder and push your kids ahead desperately, then it seems to me all of these city movements are going to expand and the examples they set could in fact lead to far more.
I think that these movements, they're leading to the establishment sort of beginning to or counter-organize in a way, but I'm not sure the establishment knows how to, because the establishment, well, I'm talking about Britain, has got very inadequate connections to the people. I mean, certainly this is true in the Labour Party. In a way, Tony Blair kind of turned the Labour Party into a very rigid organization. In the past, it's been quite a federal organization in which the left had a legitimacy, local organizing had a legitimacy, which was, in a way, maybe messy and difficult for a leader, but it meant that a leader always had feedback mechanisms. It could tell when the left was getting strong, when it needed to change course. It was a bit like a building built for earthquake. It could adapt and move with some flexibility. Blair, in a way, wanted to get rid of the left and get rid of that sort of messy uncertainty, that kind of federal character. And he turned it into a super centralized, controlled apparatus, which is in a way what led people to be so disengaged and alienated from the system. And it's now meant that those who lead it, in the establishment sense, not Jeremy, who's come up in a way in as part of the revolt, they don't understand. I mean, they, for example, they cannot understand the success of Jeremy Corbyn. They cannot understand why members flock to him, because he's not a charismatic person. He's not a great speaker. He's not a demagogue. His appeal is in his authenticity and his almost ordinariness. I mean, he's clearly very, very strong and courageous person, but you can't explain the movement around him in terms of some sort of magical charisma. It's got a deeper root than that, and they can't understand it because some of them have been almost imposed by the old Blairite centralized leadership on their local parties. So they've not come from the people, and so they've got no root other than a sort of media root, and the media root obviously has got a certain power, and the media are all completely against Corbyn. There's not one columnist really, who's supporting him.
Even in The Guardian? And
even in The Guardian, yeah. I mean, the one, Gary Young, who writes for The Nation, he's not like a fan, but he's been very sympathetic and understanding, and he knows what's going on. He's a very shrewd journalist, and so he's explaining the truth. But otherwise, you know, there's nobody who's giving Corbyn any kind of voice. And so the establishment reaction, that, you know, the recent resignations, you know, they've been completely without a plan. It's extraordinary. And to me, it's proof that really they were simply thinking that they could bully Jeremy into resigning, that they would create an atmosphere a bit like in a workplace where nobody's supporting him. He's in what we call sent to Coventry, kind of isolated. And in the end, he buckles under pressure. But he didn't, because he's surrounded by people who got a much wider mandate amongst the party membership and who give him support. So he feels he's got a mandate that he must stand up, he must champion. He can't give in, because it's not about him. He keeps saying this. It's not about me. It's about the movement that's grown up. So I think that's one factor, that we've got an establishment now biting back, but not very effectively. I mean, I don't want to be over-optimistic, because I now think there are big challenges facing Corbyn. But I think that the establishment have not got many capacities. I mean, I think in Spain it's a different situation, but there the political establishment began to recoup a bit against Podemos. I mean, I think that was more probably mistakes on Podemos' part. Their electoral rise hasn't been as strong.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole talking to Hillary Wainwright. We're discussing the current state of politics, particularly in Britain, where in England, where she lives and reports on, has been working for many years. But they all apply to the United States. Our establishment is as blind and deaf and encased in there. They all have high priests, the establishments, who tell them everything they're doing is right and it will work out, and the world's never been in better shape, and the Chinese masses are all having better lives, and Africa is really growing, and in the United States we're just having growing pains, or in England. And these movements that you see cropping up here and there, they're told that these are just the dead enders who just want to retain their privilege. They've got a whole discourse and understandings, that is, even the ones who are interested in intellectual life and in understanding the world. So I don't think we can expect much from them, but their system is failing and creating more inequality and also environmental threats. It won't come from the top. It's going to have to come from what happens on the ground as people are trying to save themselves and then coming to affiliate, right, with either a right wing who is out prospecting for votes and especially support, and they're doing quite well. Although the United States, Trump is an absurdity and might still win the election. But it seems to me it's what's happening below, even if it's really embryonic now, that's what's sort of important.
I agree with you in the sense that I think that the key question, once we've understood these movements, these political movements that we've just been discussing, I think the next step in the discussion is kind of what next. And there I think you're hinting at the issue, which is really who's got solutions to the systemic global problems that we face. And I think this then points to a different kind of movement from the movements we've had in the traditional labor movements, which have tended to be defensive. I mean, they've had to defend themselves against a lot, you know, against a sort of rampant capitalism, but they've not tended to be about alternative forms of production, alternative forms of energy, alternative environmental solutions. Whereas I think now we're seeing a slightly different kind of movement developing, which, well, to me has got some similarities to the women's movement in the sense that it's prefiguring in the present, in the solutions it finds now, it's prefiguring alternatives. So it's not happy with just protesting, just making demands on government. It's actually creating productive alternatives. So in the whole classic areas, the whole area of energy, where people are not just campaigning for renewables, they're actually creating renewables. They're organizing the installation of solar panels. They're organizing energy cooperatives to produce energy in a sustainable way. They're looking at how to convert engineering industry from weapons production to the production of wind power facilities. You know, there's a kind of creativity that I think it's really important that the new political movements find ways of supporting. I think that's a new, that generally is a new kind of politics, because the model of politics on the left has tended to be, we need progressive, enlightened experts who will plan and who will provide solutions of an enlightened kind that we'll all benefit from. And I think the new generation, which, I mean, I think this goes back actually to 68, where we really had the first break from that sort of reliance on professional expertise, and instead an assertion of a kind of practical tacit knowledge that was not expressed through individual entrepreneurs, but through collaborative movements. So the women's movement, for me, was the most formative, where we found solutions to childcare, to violence against women, to housework, by collaborating, you know, by sort of collective, cooperative childcare, new kinds of housing centres for women who'd been victims of violence or victims of rape. And then we did demand public resources to facilitate those initiatives. But the creativity was in the movements. And I think that's the pattern now, but we haven't yet got a kind of that combination of creativity from below with a facilitating kind of leadership from above. And that's what I hope will develop in the next phase of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership.
Hillary Rainwright, that was a wonderful place to conclude the interview. There really is great hope. There's also, though, real grim possibilities. And it's in that combination of creativity below and organization below and self-help below and respect and building communities of respect for all and care for all. And some of that is developing, it seems to me. Hillary Wainwright, thanks so much for talking to us, and keep up the good work. And
well, thanks, Bill. I'm happy to talk again. I've enjoyed it.
Right. And people should look up Red Pepper. Go on the web or all these other ways of finding your way to very interesting things. And consider Red Pepper. In fact, Hillary, you have a new offer, a sort of a Marxist marketing campaign, from each according to their capacities, to each according to their needs. People choose.
How do you feel?
People can choose, not quite that, but you can subscribe at basically at lower rates if you think you need the service but don't have enough money and nobody checks on you. It's an honor system. People should look at Red Pepper. Thanks a lot for talking to us, Hillary.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
Maggie's Farm by Bob Dylan. Is it possibly about Margaret Thatcher's farm? I don't know. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Has there ever been a presidential election which presented a choice between two such widely unpopular candidates? Here's Fran Michelle with some thoughts on the subject.
Good morning, Comrade Moles. A couple of weeks ago here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, I offered up a round of some left commentary against the project of voting for the presidential candidate who seems to be the lesser evil. In reply, I've heard a good many questions and comments from friends, listeners, and fellow moles. I'd like to respond to some of those today, including questions about reproductive justice, Social Security, and the Supreme Court system, but also to say a bit more about the larger frame of this conversation. For one thing, I don't know that it's entirely clear which of the two major party candidates is the lesser evil. I don't mean they're indistinguishable. Their position statements and campaign promises and slogans are quite distinct. but looking at their records, donors, and other alliances may complicate the picture somewhat, a point I'll come back to. But even if one candidate is clearly the worse evil, it does not necessarily or immediately follow that we should therefore vote for the other major party candidate. Alicia Garza, one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement, explains in an interview that even though she's clear about whom she does not want to be president, that does not mean she endorses the other major party candidate. As Garza notes, it's worth recalling that presidents have limited powers. Even if we take the candidates at their words and trust their sincere intentions, the individual executive is constrained and influenced by the legislative branch and by popular mobilization. Again, points I'll come back to. Asked about voting, Garza observes first that many are disfranchised and do not have the choice about whether to vote or for whom. Second, she deplores the polarizing conversations that accuse people of being, for instance, selfish if you don't vote or a sellout if you do. She says, quote, there's diversity in the movement about what tactics we use. If you're not participating in the electoral system, that doesn't mean you're not doing something productive to make change happen, unquote. She speaks to the importance of making sure that people are involved in a broad movement for social change. To that extent, Garza's position is like that of John Holla and Noam Chomsky in their 8-point brief for lesser evil voting. A widely shared point of agreement among those discussing this anywhere to the left of center is that just voting for president is not going to move us toward the better world we want. As Holla and Chomsky's brief puts it, quote, presidential elections perform a role in diverting the left from actions which have the potential to be effective in advancing its agenda. These include developing organizations committed to extra-political means, notably street protest, but also competing for office in potentially winnable races. The left should devote the minimum time necessary to exercise the lesser evil voting choice, then immediately return to pursuing goals which are not timed to the national electoral cycle, end quote. But here I am contributing to the potentially distracting discussion about voting for president. The urgency with which some people address these questions sometimes suggests an emotional investment in voting that risks giving too much weight to that election and ignoring the complexities of political landscapes. Perhaps I'm overly pacified by living in what appears to be a safe state. Given the lead Clinton has in polls in most states, only a few are really up for grabs. Moreover, if there's truth to the paper that found that Clinton did better in primary states that had no form of paper verification against which to check vote tallies, then perhaps they're all safe states. But a number of people I've talked to recently, even here in Blue Oregon, seem concerned that Trump is an entirely new phenomenon, and this is no time to give up on lesser evil voting. So I return to the problem of varieties of evil represented by these choices and varieties of pressures that might be brought to bear upon the office of the president, whoever might be occupying it. It's not precisely a tangent to point out that the composition of the legislative branch may be shaped by Clinton's campaign strategy of painting Trump as unlike other Republicans so that she can bring those Republicans into her camp or her administration. As Carl Baeser points out, given Trump's extreme unpopularity, Clinton should be in a position to help Democrats to win back the House and Senate, overcome Republican obstruction, and advance an agenda. But Clinton has chosen instead to consolidate her power and maintain the political status quo. As Corey Robin puts it, so long as down-ballot Republicans distance themselves from Trump, Clinton is willing to give them an out, thereby hurting their Democratic opponents. And Clinton is keeping a lot of the money her organization raised for down-ballot Democrats, doubly hurting them. So that's what's at stake with the Trump is like no Republican we've seen before. Among the Republican endorsers Clinton has rounded up is Hank Paulson, who, as Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush, presided over both the meltdown of the U.S. economy and the subsequent transfer of taxpayer funds to bail out his close friends and associates. As a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, which has paid Clinton hundreds of thousands of dollars for confidential speeches, Paulson may have more information than most of us about Clinton's likely policy goals. Paulson supports Clinton not just because he favors her positions on globalization and trade, but also because he sees her as more likely than Trump is to cut entitlements to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That is, according to Hank Paulson, if you want to save Social Security, voting for Hillary Clinton would not be a helpful move. That view seems confirmed by reports from former officials in the administration of Bill Clinton that he was planning for quick implementation of the privatization of Social Security when his plans were derailed by impeachment over the Monica Lewinsky affair. But Bill will have another shot at turning more taxpayer money over to Wall Street after his wife becomes president. She said that she plans to put him in charge of economic revitalization. So on Social Security, Clinton might simply be the more efficient evil. But what about abortion and reproductive choice? Much of the legislative battle over these issues has been taking place at the state level, so it would be helpful if Clinton were not undermining the down-ballot Democrats and supporting Republicans. As for the role of the Supreme Court, as Rob Hunter puts it in Jacobin, durable abortion rights are more likely to be secured through a broad coalition demanding universal access to single-payer health care than through appeals to protect the legacy of Roe. As legal observers from Derek Bell to Samir Chopra have argued, the Supreme Court is a fundamentally conservative institution. Further, Clinton has said that she'd be willing to compromise on reproductive rights as long as they took into consideration the life of the mother. And as Liza Featherstone has said, Clinton has said that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, that last a qualifier that contributes to the stigma against the procedure. So, not a lot of help there either. Finally, some folks have suggested to me that the danger is less from Trump than from his followers, who must not be empowered by the election of their candidate. While it's true that Trump's sanctioning of racist and xenophobic violence is disturbing, I suspect that a Clinton presidency would also rile up the Trumpists. The election of the first black president has hardly stopped the violence against black lives, and the economic conditions driving the sense of grievance among the downwardly mobile and white working class seems to me, contrary to Paulson's suggestion, unlikely to be alleviated by a new round of Clinton austerity and reform. So, however you vote, if you do, there's more to be done than pulling a lever, tapping a screen, filling a bubble, or punching a Chad. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
Tweedledum and tweedledee, they're throwing knives into the tree. Two big bags of dead man's bones, got the noses to the grindstone. Living in the land of Nod, trusting their fate to the hands of God.
Tweedledum and Tweedledee, what a choice. Larry Bolden is here now with another installment in his long-running series of fiction reviews. It was by an African-American woman who came to the U.S. to take an academic position and went home with some very American attitudes. She even makes a guest appearance on the latest album released by Beyoncé, in a song called Flawless. I would have played a bit, but unfortunately, the song contains some words not FCC approved. The title of the novel is Americana, and it's by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I'll be interested to see hear Larry's pronunciation. So here he is.
With the mellifluous name Ephemelu, writes a blog while holding a fellowship at Princeton. The blog is entitled Race Teenth, or Various Observations About Blacks, those formerly known as Negroes, by a non-American black. I could easily review Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's novel Americana simply by quoting from the many blogs incorporated into the novel, and I will quote a few. At its simplest, this is a love story. Ephemelu and Obinza meet in grade school in Lagos and have an essential connection thereafter, though they go to different continents, have other lovers, take on new personas. But while the love story aspect remains right to the end of this long and intricate novel, it's really Ephemelu's story, and Adichie has admitted that much of it is based on her own life. I was reminded of Jhumpa Lahiri, the Indian novelist, as I read this, because, like her characters, Ephemelu and Obinza are children of relatively affluent and well-educated parents when Nigeria is under a military dictatorship. And while they both desire to go to the U.S., it's not primarily for economic reasons. Obinza dreams of studying literature at Princeton. Ephemelu is less romantic in her views of the U.S. and much less certain of wanting to leave her country and her family. Ironically, and due to the politics of the times, it is she who gets the visa and ends up at Princeton. He is unable to get a travel visa and finally enters England illegally. When the reader first meets Ephemelu, she's been in the States for 13 years, and she's already decided to return to Nigeria, not because she's particularly unhappy, but simply because she wants to go home. Much of the novel, like the blogs, is critical not only of American racism, but of Americanas, with an A-H-S at the end. Nigerians who return to Nigeria only to judge it by their learned American tastes. Everywhere she turns her eye, Efemolu is analytic and usually critical, but with an underlying empathy. To note a few of her observations, quoting from the book, she did not understand grunge, the idea of looking shabby because you could afford not to be shabby. It mocked true shabbiness. And another quote, it was absurd how women's magazines forced images of small-boned, small-breasted white women on the rest of multi-boned, multi-ethnic world of women to emulate. But I keep reading them, she said. It's like smoking. It's bad for you, but you do it anyway. Close quote. There are a wealth of one-liners in this novel that would give you a real taste of its essence, but since the blogs play such an important part in the novel, I want to quote one longish blog to give you an idea of how the author is allowed to step back in some way, even from her lead character, and adopt a cool, critical voice while reflecting on what it is for a foreign-born black person to live in the U.S. And quoting the blog, "Understanding America for the Non-American Black." American tribalism in America. Tribalism is alive and well. There are four kinds: class, ideology, region, and race. First, class, pretty easy, rich folk and poor folk. Second, ideology, liberal and conservatives. They don't merely disagree on political issues. Each side believes the other is evil. Intermarriage is discouraged, and on the rare occasion that it happens, is considered remarkable. Third, region, the North and the South. The two sides fought in a civil war, and tough stains from that war remain. The North looks down on the South while the South resents the North. Finally, race. There's a ladder of racial hierarchy in America. White is always on top, specifically white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, otherwise known as WASP. And American black is always on the bottom. And what's in the middle depends on time and place. Or, as that marvelous rhyme goes, if you're white, you're all right. If you're brown, stick around. If you're black, get back. Americans assume that everyone will get their tribalism, but it takes a while to figure it all out. So, in undergrad, we had a visiting speaker, and a classmate whispers to another, "Oh, my God, he looks so Jewish," with a shudder, an actual shudder, like Jewish was a bad thing. I didn't get it. As far as I could see, the man was white, not much different from the classmate herself. Jewish to me was something vague, something biblical. But I learned quickly. You see, in America's ladder of races, Jewish is white, but also some rungs below white. A bit confusing, because I knew this straw-haired, freckled girl who said she was Jewish. How can Americans tell who is Jewish? I read somewhere how American colleges used to ask applicants for their mother's surnames to make sure they weren't Jewish, because they wouldn't accept Jewish people. So maybe that's how to tell. From people's names? The longer you're here, the more you start to get it. Close quote. Efemolu does return to Nigeria, to Lagos. Once there, she starts a new blog, one critical of Americanas. As in her American blog, there's humor, but also insight and a social surgeon's eye. She also, although not immediately, takes up with Obinze again, who is now wealthy as a land speculator and married with children. While there are several short sections of the book dealing with Obinze's life, his illegal entry into England and his deportation, it is really only in the final section that his inner life is fleshed out a bit, his agony over his love for Efemolu and what that means for his wife and his children. The reader believes his inner turmoil, and while the blogs take aim at the sexism rife in Nigeria, Adichie makes it clear that Obinze is genuinely conflicted, loves his wife and family in spite of being unable to put Efemolu and their love behind him. I won't tell you how the love story ends except to say that it is not idealized. The lead character in this novel is remarkably well drawn, complex, with contradictory desires and values. I confess to knowing next to nothing about Nigeria nor its political history, but Adichie certainly does her best to give us a long look at Nigeria as well as England and America. This was actually her fourth book, and I intend to read everything she's written. She's a wonderful writer with a rich global view. I've been talking about Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's 2013 novel, Americana. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, thank you, Larry. And like Larry says, this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Remember the euphoria following the conclusion of the 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris? Here's a couple of examples taken from the Nature Conservancy webpage. The world as a whole agreed on a path forward. 196 nations signed the Paris Agreement, the first time since climate change rocketed to the top of the list of global issues that the world has agreed on a path forward. The Paris Agreement is a turning point. The agreement signals the turning point in the road to a low-carbon economy, a road paved by continued innovation in technology, energy, finance, and conservation sectors. So, how is the agreement's implementation faring? Not so good, says Simon Fisher in an article entitled Post-Paris Climate Talks, Implementation at Any Price. The voices that celebrated the Paris Agreement yesterday sound rather less confident today, writes Fisher. Only half a year after the supposedly groundbreaking Paris Agreement on climate change was finalized by governments negotiating in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, climate policy has come back down to earth. In May, the established UNFCCC subsidiary bodies and the ad hoc working group on the Paris Agreement, APA, met in Bonn, Germany, to consider how to implement the agreement. However, it seems like parties who satisfied the agreement in Paris cannot agree on how to move forward. This is the case for Article 6 in the agreement, which deals with cooperative approaches and market mechanisms, for instance. The voices that celebrated the Paris Agreement yesterday sound rather less confident today. The ambitious goals announced in Paris are turning out to be difficult to realize in practice. No surprise here, given that they do not go to the root of the climate crisis, which is the consumption of fossil fuels. Shockingly, fossil fuels are not mentioned even once in the agreement. In addition, the models used to determine future greenhouse gas emissions levels are built on assumptions that are highly questionable, including a blind faith that technological developments such as bioenergy and carbon capture and storage can lead to negative emission scenarios, and that extensive land use change, for example, by spreading monoculture plantations, is an acceptable way forward. In Bonn, the desired target of limiting the rise of global average temperature to 1.5 degrees centigrade again came under pressure, and it seems highly unlikely to be realized under the current policy approach. This is worrying, particularly when looking at the latest trends from NASA and others. In 2016, record temperatures and other indicators of climate change, such as changing patterns of rainfall and drought, have been extreme. However, looking at the country's intended nationally determined contributions, IDNCs, which are the post-2020 climate action commitments by parties and form the foundation of the Paris Agreement, it becomes obvious that planned mitigation action has largely been shifted to post-2030. Yet in order to prevent the worst implications of climate change, action is needed immediately, as well as real and workable solutions. Business as usual and reliance on risky and questionable scenarios are certainly not an option. Accelerating implementation of the Paris Agreement was the theme of the mid-year conference in Bonn. The focus on implementation was evident. During her last intersessional meeting, Cristina Figueres, former executive secretary of the UNFCCC, announced that today the challenge is to translate intent into action that does justice to the extraordinary ambition enshrined in the Paris Agreement. However, the emphasis on implementation seemed to leave little space for a debate about crucial issues such as transparency and equity. Moreover, it also seems to come along with an emphasis on even stronger involvement of the private sector in mitigation and adaptation actions. In terms of implementation, financing seems to be crucial. Developed countries have an historical responsibility to equalize their climate debts. In the Paris Agreement, loss and damage demands of developing countries have been watered down so much that Annex I, industrialized countries, can escape that accountability almost entirely. Sadly, the implementation mania is tightly focused on creating a process that benefits the private sector. Public spending is scarce, but there are vast possibilities to invest in mitigation or adoption projects. For example, several climate funds claim to provide opportunities to offset emissions by supposedly investing in mitigation programs such as reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation and others. However, these projects often lead to biodiversity loss and human rights violations. Furthermore, relying on private investment that are inevitably likely to be focused on generating profits over a relatively short timescale is dangerous and can seriously threaten environmental and social integrity. This collides with the concept of sustainability and often conflicts with human rights issues and environmental integrity. Furthermore, private investments mainly come in the form of loans instead of grants. Loans lead to dependency and increase inequality between North and South. Besides transparency and equity issues, another point where a deficit can be observed is policy coherence. Looking at recent developments, there seems to be a developing trend that agreements decided upon today are forgotten tomorrow, and it certainly seems to apply to current climate policy. If climate policy cannot ensure coherence, it makes the implementation of new agreements for the most part ineffective and leaves climate policy as an unreliable instrument to overcome dangerous impacts of climate change. In the run-up to the next UN Climate Change Conference, which will take place in the end of 2016 in Marrakesh, climate policy negotiations look set to shoot back up into the stratosphere, with implementation mania taking pride of place, while crucial issues continue to be ignored. This cannot be allowed to happen. When it comes to mitigation and adaption measures, the focus should be put on community conservation approaches instead of large-scale mitigation projects financed by loans. Such initiatives are much more effective and can ensure environmental and social integrity. People living in and off of the forest have proven the sustainability of this approach for centuries. Their real interest in preserving their homes cannot be taught by actors from outside, who are much more likely to have financial interests as their top priority anyway. By involving the private sector, climate policy risks becoming the devil's advocate. To address the climate crisis, we certainly cannot rely on non-binding agreements built upon false solutions and fanciful models. A set of real solutions based on leaving fossil fuels in the ground and protecting forests, implemented in transparent and equitable ways, has to be the number one priority. Moreover, the implementation of and coherence with other existing intergovernmental agreements addressing related issues should be preconditioned for implementation. Otherwise, we may find that it is the Paris Agreement itself that is the main obstacle in the fight against devastating climate change impacts. If the UNFCCC cannot find the political will to ensure equity, transparency, and coherence, it will end up losing its credibility and subsequently its legitimacy as the overarching body dedicated to protecting us from dangerous climate change. That was an article by Simon Fisher entitled Post-Paris Climate Talks, Implementation at Any Price. Fisher is the Climate and Land Use Policy Advisor at Global Forest Coalition. The article can be found on the new Internationalist webpage. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every day, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. For the most effective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission.